It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Joff Parrish, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Well, let's jump into...
Well, I had a couple things to throw in first.
Okay.
We don't have nearly as many stories as we had last week when we had, what, 20 stories in 30 minutes? It was just kind of insane.
Mm-hmm.
So we may actually have time this week to do something we haven't done in a while, which is take email queries from listeners. So if you have a question, email it in, and hopefully we'll have time at the end of the show to... take on a question or
if
two.
It's short and sweet.
Yes. So what is the address?
dj@kexp.org.
And then the other thing is I'm going to try and experiment the next couple weeks, and I'll be off on the road for 3 weeks after that, and I'm not sure whether I'm going to try new phone things or not, but we certainly won't do this. But at least for the next couple weeks, and then maybe on an ongoing basis, oddly enough, I'm not all doing this off the top of my head. One of the things, magical things about radio is that I can cheat, and, you know, have a few words here and there to prompt my memory about what these stories are. What I'm going to try and do the next couple weeks is actually type out the stories, based on my notes and post it on the blog after the radio show, the state blog, so that if you miss the program 1 week or another, you can actually have access to the stories. Imagine that. And that's, you know, www.eatthestate.org, and then you click the link on the right-hand side to the blog. So I'll have that up by this afternoon, and we'll try it the next couple of weeks and see how it works out. And, you know, if you have feedback on that, if you think it's a great idea, if you think it's a waste of my time, I'd like to know that too so I don't have to do it. Let us know.
Okay. And, of course, if that isn't up in by this afternoon, then Job gives out his personal phone number at the end of the show.
Yes, so. Exactly.
All right. Well, let's just start out with local. Virginia Mason is attempting to do something interesting.
Yeah, this is a huge story that up until I had put an article on the Seattle Weekly website yesterday, no local media, and for that matter, no national media that I can tell of, has been reporting it. And it is a national story. The national story is that the National Labor Relations Board, which under Bush has at least according to the organizing director of AFL-CIO, who I talked to a couple of days ago, had the worst labor record since Herbert Hoover, and the NLRB board not only consistently rules against working interests, but unlike its predecessors, doesn't even hold hearings or have public process on these issues, and isn't this time either. There's a series of three cases collectively known as the Kentucky River cases. And what the NLRB is proposing to do is reclassify any kind of worker that might have any kind of oversight, no matter how fleeting, over another worker, over a colleague or coworker. For example, you know, trade union members that have apprentices, or you know, people who have oversight over less senior folks, lead men in mines or manufacturing, nurses with nurses' aides, you know, that kind of thing, that they will all be reclassified as supervisors, and under Taft-Hartley, supervisors are not eligible to form unions. So it's an instant way to make 1.5 million union members ineligible for unions. And oddly enough, one of the first test cases of that is in Seattle. Virginia Mason Hospital, as part of an ongoing series of NLRB hearings around its controversial policy of mandatory flu shots for all its employees, even the ones that have nothing to do with patient care, which is most of them, that's being has been litigated by the nurses union, the Washington State Nurses Association. This has been going on for months. And at a hearing in June, under sworn testimony, the senior nursing officer for Virginia Mason offered a novel argument against the hospital having to negotiate these changes in work conditions with the union, that all 600 of Virginia Mason's registered nurses were supervisors and therefore were ineligible to be in the union. What Virginia Mason is trying to do is bust the union by reclassifying all 600 of its nurses as supervisors. This, you know, it's a big deal, and it could affect not just nurses, about 300,000 around the country, but all sorts of different industries. So there's going to be a demonstration in front of Virginia Mason, 4 o'clock on Monday, from 4 to 5. And then local labor folks, the Virginia Mason Nurses, the Washington State Labor Council, et cetera, are asking that people can contact their congresspeople and have the congresspeople pressure the NLRB to actually hold public hearings and consider how this proposed regulation change will affect actual working people. This is something the Bush administration has done very often, especially with environmental laws. Rather than taking a controversial measure through Congress where it would have a hard time passing, you know, just change the definition of a few words in the regulations and does the trick. Very underhanded. It's gotten virtually no publicity, and we need to start talking about it and stopping it.
All right, moving along. Critical Mass is a gathering of bicyclists that happens once a month, and this last one got a bit of coverage.
Yeah, last Friday, they ride on the last Friday of every month, and it's, you know, 200-300 bicyclists that get out in the road and ride around usually the downtown area and adjacent neighborhoods to make a statement that bicyclists are part of the road and a good alternative means of transportation. And there's a whole sort of, you know, bike messenger and anarchist subculture that is kind of the ethos of Critical Mass. It's been going on in Seattle for about a decade. And occasionally they have run-ins with police. And this one was particularly nasty. What happened was that several undercover King County Sheriff's officers who were doing Metro bus duty were stopped as the bicyclists rode past, and of course the bicyclists do their own monitoring of, you know, people who get off their bikes and stop traffic so that the mass of bicyclists can pass. It's very similar to how a lot of demonstrations and marches do that. These burly cops come pouring out of the van in what's apparently just a case of road rage and start attacking the guy who was stopping traffic, and one of the bicyclists got off his bike and went to the aid of his buddy because all he saw was some burly guys in civilian clothes attacking this guy. They didn't identify themselves as cops and they started pounding on this guy, and then they announced themselves as cops. And this is according to the bicyclist, of course. The police have a very different story. There's been no decision yet as to whether he's been charged. He was certainly in jail over the weekend. And this has gotten a lot of publicity. It's actually very similar to an incident in February 1997 when in the first few months of Eat the State, we covered it quite a bit when the Seattle Police Department charged three Critical Mass bicyclists with, beating on the police with their faces and, pounding their heads against the boots of the policemen. It's been a very different reaction this time, though. There's been much more skepticism from the media about the police claims. There's been much more skepticism about politicians. Ron Sims came out, the King County executive, came out a couple days ago and said that he found the actions of the sheriff somewhat troubling, and he thinks there needs to be an investigation, etc. You didn't see any of this at all 9 years ago. So it's very interesting that the culture has changed a little bit, even though the Critical Mass riders themselves are just as anti-establishment and, you know, probably just as frowned upon by, you know, establishment media and political figures as they ever have been. But there's been more skepticism toward the police claims.
All right, moving along and jumping to national, do some updates on some scandals, starting with the NSA phone monitoring.
Yeah, interesting stuff that came out this week. In a lawsuit that was filed in New York State against AT&T for providing database information to the NSA, it was alleged that the NSA actually attempted to get AT&T to cooperate in handing over phone records 7 months before 9/11. They wanted AT&T to build a duplicate call switching center that would enable the NSA to get the calls directly. AT&T declined, NSA went ahead and developed its own technology that essentially accomplished pretty much the same thing. Interesting development. Also, USA Today backed down from its original May story that said that Verizon and Bell South also provided data on phone records to the NSA. They came out with a story saying, well, they kind of still think it's true, but they cannot prove it any longer. And Bell South and Verizon have both denied that all along. So, you know, make of that what you will. But AT&T definitely seems to be involved.
All right. Well, Verizon is well known, though, for willingly selling off its databases to whoever wants.
Yeah, Verizon's got plenty of problems with or without the NSA.
All right, moving along, the Abramoff scandal update as well.
Yeah, there were, and there's a banking scandal update too, but we'll do Abramoff first.
Okay.
The Inspector General of the Department of Justice came out with an interesting report this week that didn't get a whole lot of attention, suggesting that the lobbyist Jack Abramoff, who's, you know, now on his... facing a few years in prison for his various hijinks, also had his tentacles into the Bush administration Department of Justice, particularly through a guy named Kevin Ring, who is a former aide to John Ashcroft. Ashcroft, of course, ran the DOJ during Bush's first term, and as the Attorney General. Attorney General, is that right? Yeah,
Ashcroft was Attorney General.
Yeah, he was Attorney General.
The
shock still hasn't worn off. But in any event, that connection helped kill a couple of corruption probes, one into a proposed court reforms in Guam, and another into alleged corruption in a legislative election in the Northern Marianas Islands. Both were associated with Abramoff when he was a lobbyist with Seattle-based Preston Gates Ellis prior to 2001. So it looks like yet another Bush agency has been went over to the dark side in terms of its relationship with Abramoff. It just keeps expanding.
All right, and you had mentioned, yeah, banking records. What's up
yeah,
with that?
What's up with that is that the AP has been reporting this week that money transfer agencies such as Western Union have delayed or blocked thousands of cash transfers and deliveries since 9/11 and you'll love this, on suspicion of terrorist connections for the recipients or the senders, simply because the senders or the recipients had names like Mohammed or Ahmed, and those names showed up pretty regularly on the Department of Homeland Security watch list, and therefore the U.S. Treasury Department issued guidelines that Western Union had to follow all around the world, saying that people who sent or received that had those names, those had to be flagged, and sometimes the transactions were delayed, sometimes they were never completed at all.
So does that mean Ahmed Chalabi didn't get his Western Union transfers as expected?
I think he had an aide do that for him, probably somebody in the State Department.
Yeah. I actually think he probably goes through a little bit bigger banks than Western
Union. That's true, too.
All right. Sticking with national, the EPA has libraries?
Yes, they do, and the Bush administration research libraries, which have a tremendous amount of information that research scientists have accumulated over the years on, you know, things like pollution in rivers and clean water and clean air and so forth. And the Bush administration is threatening to close down all those libraries. They zeroed out the budget for next fiscal year. Well, 10,000 EPA research scientists signed a letter and presented it to Congress this week, asking Congress to stop the defunding of the EPA libraries, which is just, you know, sort of an unprecedented step for government bureaucrats, let alone that many of them. So it really tells you how the anti-science Bush administration has alienated actual scientists that work for the federal government.
All right. Well, with all the different intelligence scandals that are happening around the country, it looks like California, not to be outdone by any of those, is gathering data itself.
Yeah, we've heard a lot about anti-war demonstrators and other dissidents being monitored by the federal government, but this is something of a new twist that the state of California has also been doing it. Report in the Los Angeles Times this week that under Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, California's Department Department of Homeland Security has been issuing daily reports since March of this year, listing political and anti-war demonstrations across the state. Interestingly enough, an awful lot of, about 60 of them since March. Interestingly enough, a lot of their sources for these compilations have been different federal agencies, including a number of federal agencies not previously associated with monitoring dissidents, such as immigration officials, for example. It looks like the suppression of dissent in this country is alive and well and spread out amongst just an incredible array of government agencies, federal and state, and, you know, with the joint federal state local anti-terrorism quote unquote task forces, local officials as well.
All right. And then finally on national, it looks like three different senators are writing a letter to the attorney general.
Yeah, Senator, and they're all Republicans, I believe, too. Charles Grassley, Chuck Grassley of Iowa, John McCain of Arizona, and John Warner of Virginia have all written a letter questioning Boeing's practice of trying to deduct $650 million in penalties assessed to it in the corruption scandal around an Air Force contract for an air tanker that came up and besmirched Boeing's previously good name a couple 3 years ago. Boeing has been trying to take those penalties and deduct them from their taxes as business expenses, and these senators are calling attention to that practice and questioning it. And of course, the logical question comes to mind of you know, here in the state of Boeing, with our senators from Boeing, whether we might have congressional leaders, particularly any that are up for re-election, say Maria, that might also question this practice, whether they have the guts to do that or whether they're still rolling over and carrying water in favors for Boeing.
Yeah, they sure like to take credit whenever Boeing makes a sale. So
yeah, exactly.
All right, and finally on national, a magazine I'd never heard about, but I'm not in the age bracket that it targets, Cobblestone.
Yeah, it's a magazine for 9 to 14-year-olds, and it shows up in schools and libraries all over the country, and it has run into a tad bit of controversy with its latest issue, because its latest issue is essentially entirely given over to a recruiting pitch for the U.S. Army. This is for 9 to 14-year-olds. Go through this, that it issue features a cover photo of a soldier in Iraq lovingly clutching a machine gun, and articles on what it's like to go through boot camp, a rundown of the Army's quote awesome arsenal, and that's a direct quote, and detailed descriptions of Army career opportunities. Most controversial in this whole thing is a set of classroom guides that teachers can use in schools to go along with this issue that suggest that teachers invite an Army recruiter, a soldier, or a veteran to come speak to the classes and ask them if they would want to consider a career in the United States Army or if they would want to enlist. So it's real interesting that they're targeting some of the younger audience like this. Of course, the Armed Services have also for a long time been leading advertisers on things like, you know, children's cartoons and, you know, right along with pre-sweetened breakfast cereals. They definitely go after the younger kids. And, of course, with the recruiting shortfalls, they're doing so even more now. But something that anti-recruitment movements might be looking for in the schools and other places.
Well, they had been to make up for a shortfall on recruitment, you know, expanding their age spread, you know, so maybe they're heading in the lower direction.
We require that you have graduated from elementary school before you can enlist in the U.S. Army. Yeah.
All right. And actually, finally, tangential to that, the Lieutenant Aaron Witato was charged this week.
Yes, he was. Well, so. And that's certainly something we want to keep an eye on. And when that court-martial comes up, we should be all over it because that'll probably happen at Fort Lewis, that there should be, fairly broad shows of public support for him.
Okay. Well, let's jump to international. And last week we reported that last Sunday was a major election in Mexico.
Yeah, and I said something about how the Bush administration has been pouring money in to help out the conservative PAN candidate, and it looked like it might be Florida and Ohio all over again. And sure enough, that's exactly what's happened. The Mexican presidential candidate Felipe Calderon of PAN has declared victory with a less than 1% margin, and his opponent for that matter, much of the Mexican public has cried foul. The left of center PRD candidate, his name is Andre Obrador. He's having a rally today in Mexico City. He's disputing it. He's also threatening civil disobedience. He's also saying he's going to go to the courts. It's a much more aggressive response than, say, Al Gore or John Kerry or the Democratic Party, or for that matter, the American public has managed to muster over similar vote fraud in the United States. But there's much more of a history of it in Mexico. The PRI had those kind of practices for years, and there was specifically a 1988 election under very similar circumstances where there was clear vote fraud as with the Bush administration now, was very much supported by the Reagan administration then. And voters in Mexico, maybe unlike the voters up here, seem to have very long memories. So at minimum, this is not going to do a great deal for U.S.-Mexican relations. But, beyond that, I think you could see a lot of demonstrations and a lot of unrest in Mexico in coming weeks. Eat the State has an article in this issue, which should be up online anytime, from Troy Skiles, our former editor who's down in Mexico, and he's going to keep reporting on this for us because it's actually a major story with a lot of implications for the United States and a lot of implication of the United States, too.
Right. Okay, and Palestine-Israel continues to spiral.
Oh, an awful lot going on this week in that grim scenario. Israeli leaders have rejected a Hamas and Palestine offer of a ceasefire. They've continued to shell Gaza this week. They've continued to bomb and to cut off food and water. Food and water are running out, along with medical supplies. 800,000 of the 1.4 million residents of Gaza do not have electricity. This in the heat of the Middle East summer, so they don't have access to air conditioning or power to run the wells either. It really is a nasty, nasty situation. You also had Israel this week kidnapping an additional five parliamentary aides to go along with the 60-plus MPs that it's already essentially holding hostage. You had really one of the few sane voices in Israel over this being the father of the soldier whose kidnapping by Palestinian militants is the pretext for all of this collective punishment. He came out in the Israeli media on Monday saying something to the effect that that if Israel thought this sort of collective punishment was going to make any headway in changing the behavior of Palestinians, that they were delusional. And of course he's right, because as long as the occupation goes on, this sort of resistance is going to go on as well. The United States came out and was exposed this week as being the main obstacle to international efforts to try and bring humanitarian aid to the people of the Gaza Strip. The U.S. is very much implicated in all of these Israeli government actions, and has been very much supportive of it, both diplomatically and financially as well, really. And then, as if Israel is committing enough war crimes and violations of international law this week, in yet another sobering echo of 60 or 70 years ago, the Israeli newspaper Haaretz was reporting this week that a Jerusalem hospital was carrying out illegal medical experiments on mostly Arab diabetic women between 2000 and 2003. So you can add medical experiments to the list of troublesome Israeli practices.
All right. Moving from that to Iraq.
Couple of things this week. The Baghdad morgue put out its monthly report of corpses that have died violent deaths in the Baghdad area in the month of June in this case, 1,595. That's a 15% increase, which kind of puts the lie, and mostly that's due to sectarian violence, death squads and the like, kind of puts the lie to the idea that the death of Zarqawi is going to lead to any kind of reduction whatsoever in the violence in Iraq. We saw more details emerge on the charging of a soldier with the rape and four murders of a family in a town in Iraq south of Baghdad. The girl, and it wasn't a woman, it was a girl, 15 years old, who was raped and then murdered. The family apparently lived near a U.S. Army checkpoint. The girl was unusually pretty. The family had feared for some time that she might be approached, and she was apparently continually harassed by different U.S. soldiers, and these four soldiers came to the family's house, and the girl was raped, and then the family members were killed, and the soldier that was charged also apparently tried to set the girl's body on fire before the soldiers left, and then there was a concerted effort to cover it up as well. So it's a very, very disturbing story. Rape is very much a verboten, shameful act in Muslim and Iraqi society. It's, you know, one more nail in the coffin of trying to win over the hearts and minds of Iraqi citizens.
All right. And then briefly, Iran.
Yeah, a great article in the New Yorker this week about, from Seymour Hersh, once again on Iran. He focuses primarily on the Pentagon fighting, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff in particular, fighting very hard the Bush war plans around Iran. And he does also report that opposition by the Joint Chiefs of Staff has essentially killed the idea of using tactical nuclear weapons in Iraq. But there's also a lot of friction between the Joint Chiefs and Donald Rumsfeld, and so Rumsfeld, for that reason, is starting to rely very heavily on special operations in Iran. So a lot of covert action going on there right now. And it's Seymour Hersh in the New Yorker this week.
All right. And 30 seconds or less, North Korea.
The U.S. has offered bilateral talks with North Korea after North Korea shot off seven errant ballistic missiles on Wednesday. They offered bilateral talks today in direct contradiction to what the Bush administration has done with Iraq and Iran and any other perceived enemy over the last several years. So deterrence does seem to work.
Okay. And quickly, events.
Again, Virginia Mason trying to reclassify all 600 of its nurses as supervisors, and they're therefore ineligible to join the union that they already belong to. There's going to be a demonstration at Virginia Mason, 4 o'clock to 5 o'clock Monday afternoon. That's up on First Hill.
All righty. And see if I can get back to... Sorry, should have had this ready. Your quick question, do you find the timing of the, talking about Ken Lay, do you find the timing of his death suspicious? It essentially makes sure he won't ever talk about his relationship with the Bush White House and ends any civil suits against him.
I, you know, there's no way of proving that. I mean, you know, there's, you know, they you know, The anti-Clinton people were trying to pin Vince Foster on the Clinton administration for years and years and years after his suicide. And, you know, maybe there was something there. Probably there wasn't. I tend to feel the same way about Ken Lay in the absence of any evidence. It's just it's circumstantial, really.
All
and,
right.
You know, 50-some-year-old men under a great deal of stress do have heart attacks.
Yes, they do. All right. Well, unfortunately, there's some other questions that came in, which is great, but we don't have any more time to cover those. So
I talk too much. Sorry about that.
Talking once again with Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State? And what's your personal phone number you give out each week?
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks. It's a volunteer publication of local and national and international news. You find it where you find free publications, bookstores, cafes, King County Library System, you know, wherever you pick up publications like that. It's also on the web, www.eatthestate.org. And as I mentioned, I'm going to try out for a little while, typing up these stories and putting them on the blog. So if you miss 1 week, you can refer to them, or if you didn't catch something, and sometimes I don't go into all the detail I have because we just don't have time. That's at the blog, there's a link on the right-hand column of the front page at www.eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, whatever, it's my personal number. Sure it is. right. It's a voicemail. The number is area code 206-719-6947.